Is it official? It's official. Okay, we can all go home. Let's party. Okay, Rabbi Noel is acting as moderator. Again, I personally just want to tell you, if I make a grimace or a face at you, it's either because I'm in pain or because I'm trying to make a face at you. So assume that I'm in pain. Okay, don't take it personally, please.
Let's get our first. So anyway, we're waiting here.
No questions.
Just
everybody
quick,
wants
we're
to.
Done. I think we're done.
We're just going to.
Oh, okay. No, yeah.
What's the topic?
Oh, you could get in trouble with Yitz. It means you don't read his sign.
I think the topic is. I think official topic is now spirituality and technological age, which I don't know what that really means. I think it's.
Can we get the sheet from on the board with what Rabbi Yitz wrote? We're going to find out. Everybody send Rav Yitz a text message. Everybody said, what is this supposed to be about? You know, let him find the goal.
Is spirituality dead? How to connect to God in the scientific...
Is spirituality dead?
And in the scientific and technological world.
How to connect to God in a scientific and technological world. Okay.
No, you have a question now.
God doesn't have faith.
Spirituality dead in it.
No, in all seriousness. We're done. Okay, Cal. Done.
A lot of modern historians reject the validity of the Bible as a historical work. A lot of people claim that Ezra wrote the Bible. If that were to be true, would you be able to reconcile it with your faith?
To reconcile it with what? With what?
With your faith.
I thought this was how to connect to God. It's not. You did not listen to the question.
I'll respond. There's going to be another Yom Iyun next week on Tanakh. That's a great place to ask it.
Yeah. Right.
That's great. Okay.
No, because I wanted to. Those are different questions. The question is whether or not you can connect to God. There's a God. Okay? And the question is whether you can connect to Him, what we call prayer or prophecy or something. That's independent of your question, which is a fair question. So I want to stick to... This is being recorded. If Rav Yitz found out that you asked a question like that, you'd find your bed strip tonight.
Yeah.
Excuse me. You know what? The person who asked the question, let them stand up. I can hear that you have a very cultured accent, but I can't hear your question. So stand up and speak English.
Sort of listening to the different talks that have sort of gone on today and different things that have been said, in my own mind, I'm sort of quite confused. As a Jewish person, I'm not saying we're one-dimensional, but is our main purpose to look to be serving God correctly or to be finding this spiritual connection? Because they definitely conflict one another, and I feel like trying to do one often hinders the other. And which one is kind of the ikkar, in a sense? Which one is more important to strive for?
Don't worry. I just want to say something personal. I'm not speechless. However, that's part of the thing. We look at each other, you know, like who's the real person going to answer? So. I know people have looked at Morty. Morty, is.
Valley,
yeah. Okay, I'll argue with you, whatever you say.
Sorry. What are you referring to when you say there's a contradiction between the two?
Well,
in other words, one might think that they work together very nicely.
It just sounds like, for instance, today we're talking how there are various comments such as it's very easy to kind of be a robotic kind of Jew and to not really find the spirituality and this connection. And the whole point is that if you don't look for that connection between God, then you're really sort of missing the point. And I was thinking, listening to that surely... I don't, you know what I mean? Surely if I'm trying to do everything and I'm serving and I'm trying to do all what we're supposed to do in the mitzvah and the Torah, is that not enough? I've got to then go for the spirituality. And if I'm going for the spirituality, in my mind, I think it's quite easy to say, look, I'm trying to figure out my connection with God and I can't really find it. And that justifies me not doing anything. And I find it can end up being a cop-out. I'm just don't understand which one is more important to pursue. Is it better to be the Jew who serves and doesn't think, or the Jew who just thinks and therefore lets the serving fall by the wayside?
Look back at you.
What?
To me, that sounds like a question of if you can have jello without a mold, or mold without a jello. Which is better?
One second. Rabbi Grummet has forgotten. Wait a second. Okay.
What? We're gonna take care of that.
Excuse me. Rabbi Grummet forgot that this is only Adar Aleph, right? And he thought we're only a week from Purim, so that's one of those questions. Look, the goal of Judaism, I don't believe, is to be a robot, okay? To just mindlessly do things, right? One hopes that by doing things, one goes a little bit further and begins to question why they're doing things. Once you begin to question, hopefully you can come to spirituality. Of course, you could stop. Now, I often quote in the context specifically of tefillah that the Alexandrova Rebbe once said to his Hasidim, it would be worthwhile every so often to skip a tefillah so that it not become habit and rote. He would have said robotic if he knew what a robot was, but in 1850 they didn't have robots. Okay, so it would be worthwhile to skip a mincha, for example, right? Just so it not become a habit. Well, one of the Hasidim, you know, there's a lot of these Hasidic stories. There's always one Hasid who's there to ask the question, right? So the Hasid says, "So Rebbe, why don't you skip a tefillah every so often?" And the Alexandrova Rebbe said, "Because that would become a habit." Right? So the two are not at odds. I just think that it's sad that a lot of people, look, we all begin in a kind of a mechanical fashion. You can't really explain to a 7-year-old why you're doing X or why you're doing Y, right? And there are many Jews, maybe even members of the United Synagogue, which in England is the Orthodox, right? Members of the United Synagogue who come to shul and go blah 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 and have no idea of what they're saying. Right? Believe it or not, guys from America, it could be that there are people in America, could be there are people in this room, in this Beit Midrash, who say blah blah blah. You don't even know what you're saying. Right? But hopefully, that starting from there you begin to question. Right? You can't, for example, nobody can to my mind, nobody can question why pray. Okay? Why pray if you don't even know what you're saying when you pray? I can understand that somebody should say, what's the point of going before God? Blah, 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 if it doesn't mean anything at all. But growing up is beginning to question things and beginning to seriously look for answers. Those answers, I believe, are answers of spirituality. I think I wasn't here today. I didn't hear what people said, but to the degree that you have this impression that it's either you're a member of the Jew Club, the Orthodox Jewish Reconstructionist Club, and you all get together and put on, we get together every so often and we put on boxes on our heads, you know, and so on and so forth, and we go blah blah blah, and that somehow makes God happy with us, and it rains. Or the other possibility that spirituality, you know, like we all go to the Big Sur, you know what that is? Okay, it's not in England, okay? So, and we all contemplate the beauties of nature and eternal verities and all that kind of stuff, as if these are these are, there's a development. And I believe that that's the goal. I think that it's not this or that.
I thought it was serious. And then let me explain. Spirituality is something amorphous. If we seek spirituality just for spirituality's sake and there's no form, then I go back to the image. It's like having jello with no mold. You can't do anything with it. It may be very beautiful, it may taste very nice, but you can't eat it. You can't do anything with it. You have spirituality without form. There's nothing to stop it from becoming paganism or some other ism. When you have the form is the structure, the form is the mitzvot. The form allows that spirituality to take on a particularly Jewish expression. But when you have just a form without what goes into it, you have nothing. You have a piece of Tupperware that sits in your closet. When you have the mitzvot, and the mitzvot are simply an external expression, then you have very little. You have the tool that may enable for spirituality. You have the tool that may enable for religious expression, but you don't really have religious expression. So, even though it is Adar, and is only Adar Aleph, I still believe in jello inside of a mold.
No, okay.
So from those two answers, I understand from our webinar that you should start with the action and then hopefully spirituality comes from that. Correct? Right? But from our webinar, which one comes first?
It's sort of like asking the question of which comes first, the chicken or the egg. I'm serious.
Metaphor day.
Noam, Nasa v'nishma. I mean, that's what it is, Nasa v'nishma. Right? You have to do something to Tamu Ru'uki Tov Hashem, right? You have to do it. That's what I think, you know.
Sam, yeah?
From a personal point of view, how did each of you go about developing your own spirituality, your own sense of bonding with God, and how did you come to grow as a person?
You can
have an
hour.
Okay.
I guess it's like a. I guess I'm not as self-aware as many of you are, so I can't like answer that as well. First of all, just my personality, I'll be honest, I'm somewhat of a rule follower. Like, rules just work for me. They make me happy. Like, I think I was talking
to you. You should go to law school.
But that's where I learned how to break rules. But anyway, so law school is where I started. Like, anyway, so organization to me is like a very huge factor in my life. Meaning, like, I think of organization I find my creativity in organization. In that way, in certain organizing things, in a certain fashion. So to me, like, I think there was a certain sense where you, like in high school, I guess it was, maybe like ninth grade or something, where you had to make a decision at some point. Where, like, how serious is this, really, is Judaism going to be part of your life? Like, how serious a factor it was. I was, like, in my family, I was kind of, like, at some point in ninth grade, I decided whether I was going to, like, I was in a family where you daven was a given. You know, whatever time you woke up, like, you know, the first question you were asked, let's say, even I woke up at 12 o'clock on a Sunday morning, did you daven yet? And that was a given. It wasn't about the quality of davening, but that you daven was a given in the family. We weren't a shul-going family on Sundays. We were a Shabbos-going family. What's called a chakras was a given in the family. I think at some point, like, it was a ninth or tenth grade, where I made a decision, like, how serious is davening going to be for me? How am I going to take, like, this commitment or obligation to it? And kind of that's where it started, in a sense. That's when I made the decision to start going to Minyan. Like eight o'clock. Like, it was 8 o'clock Minyan, and that was like a limited decision. In other words, I wasn't getting up earlier than 8 o'clock, so it kind of worked that way. I think I found my most path intellectually through like studying Torah, and it really spoke to me in a certain sense. I found, this is my own personal sense, I still find this way, like, it's like touching the face of God in a certain sense. I found through the Torah, I feel that spiritual lifting. I understand God's world in a certain way, the way God operates the world in a certain way, the God's justice or God's ritual issue. And I think that's kind of the way I personally grew that way. First of all, I think over time was little decisions of how much further am I going to take like my commitment level. You know, so, or what's called, or my idea. And at what point am I going to start, like, really analyzing? In terms of spirituality, though, just, I remember this one chavrusa I had in Shalvim, an older chavrusa, was around the Hanukkah time. And I basically come to him with a goal that I was going to study as much more as possible. And at one point, he was an older chavrusa, and he was like, have you done any machshav yet? It was a Hanukkah or something. And I was like, the shut off guy, and he was giving me all speech, and I was like, can you just please pass the Gemara? You know, like, and that was like really how it ended. And but I took from that kind of idea of like, I think as I got older, maybe more at the end of Shalom, in college, I got more into like Jewish philosophy and kind of looking for those ideas and really kind of a more of a what's behind it in a deeper sense than what's the spurs behind it or like kind of the technical issues. You know, I find technical issues very exciting. I still find them exciting. I think that's kind of the path I took in terms of that way.
I have a slightly different story, despite, I think we... I mean, spirituality is a strange word. It means a lot to a lot of different people, and it manifests itself in different ways as well. I've always thought that spirituality starts off in a spark. In other words, something ignites, and it has a life of its own. And in different people, it goes in different directions, and it can manifest itself when you're in 10th grade or 12th grade or in college in very different ways. And I don't think anyone's story, anyone's journey is really ever the same, or should it be the same. I remember, everyone's path towards whatever spirituality means, or towards whatever God awareness, belief, whatever these terms mean, starts in a different point, at a different age perhaps, a different level of awareness, and very often in a different incident, or a different life experience. Depending whether I'm proud or embarrassed to say, I think I became aware of what God really meant in my, I would say the beginning of my path was probably in 10th grade on the baseball field. I'll give a little background. For those of you that you have no reason to know, I don't really play sports. I think the only sport I play is softball. That's probably a reason for that. That's up there as one of the reasons. And for me, 9th grade, I discovered that I actually had a couple of muscles over here on different parts of the arm, and the ball would move pretty quickly, and it worked out nicely. Needless to say, I'm pretty sure I was 0 for 6 in the first year in TABC in 9th grade. I was the worst player on the team and the most hated and dreaded player on the team because every time I pitched, I lost. And every time the other pitcher pitched, he won. The only problem was that he decided not to show up every once in a while for reasons I can't go into right now. Yeah, that was it. 10th grade, I had a little ritual. Since we talk about rituals, I had a ritual. I mean, I could probably rationalize it that I spent the summer working out and training. But for me, I had a ritual of saying certain psukim, specifically certain tefillot that I had... In a sense, just certain Yom Kippur tefillot that I felt were very powerful, that I would walk around the mound, and I would say psukim, and I would say, look, I can't pitch. I stink. And there was something about that season, for the record, Cy Young, I 3 one-hitters, was apparently very good that year, down 2 since, but there was something that I felt that I wasn't alone in a sense, that there was something beyond me being there. And I want to be honest, this story may sound very funny for some of you, but the experience of realizing that there's something there beyond yourself happens to everyone in a very different way. But once it's there, at that point it simply grows. When the awareness is there, it spreads in a sense like wildfire. So it starts there, and then it moves to the next part in your life. I mean, the intellectual, I'd say the Talmud Torah part took off a little bit later. But it affects itself piece by piece. And don't expect it to overcome you completely in a second. But let it go, piece by piece, and do it real.
There's the long version and the short version. Long version, I don't know. The short version is that from as far back as I have memories, I felt religious inside. the black sheep in my family, or the white sheep, depending on how you want it. And it expressed itself at different points in different ways. At one point, at various points, it expressed itself through tefillah when I was very young, sometimes through music, sometimes through a very deep commitment to what was ethical and what was right, sometimes in the commitment to Am Yisrael. Like when I was in high school, every Sunday afternoon we stood protesting outside the Soviet mission to allow Soviet Jews to go free. So at different points in my life it expressed itself in different ways, but I think I always felt, I don't know where it came from, but I always felt some very, very deep, deep kind of religious spirituality.
Listen, if I talked about my family, so I have to lie down and take take some medication. But my father was a rabbi, so that's what where I was brought up. He was a victim in his own way of the Holocaust, and the way he was victimized was that he wound up having to be a rabbi in America rather than a lawyer in Germany. So, but I didn't start going to yeshiva until the eighth grade. And rather, it was my choice, actually, to go to Yeshiva High School, because otherwise, two blocks away from me was Long Branch High School, where I could have starred on the football team, because even though I'm Jewish, I did more than softball. Get that, Cal? Okay, right? So, or I could have bowled for dollars or something like that. Look, I don't know. It was certainly emotionally important for me. I really loved learning Gemara in high school, but I would say the point at which I began to really, really get the sense of something beyond connected with this took place in the summer that I was 14 years old. My parents had moved to Montreal, 15 years old, and I was going to spend my last year in high school in a right wing yeshiva. Tells yeshiva in, and during that summer, I heard the Rav for the first time, and the Rav was speaking. I don't know exactly what he was speaking about, but he was talking about what happens when we say kedusha. And he said, "I'm sorry. You see, I have an advantage over you, and it's a disadvantage in trying to speak to you." When I tell the story, as I've told it many times, I hear the Rav again, and I see the Rav again. And it's kind of like sad that you guys have to hear me, you know? But that's what you have, so what can you do? I'm just telling you, you know, as a Hasidic story about stories is, the Rishoner, your great-great-great-grandfather, used to tell the story that sometimes you have nothing left to do, you don't know what to do but to tell the story. So I'm telling the story. When the Rav said, talking about what he was talking about, he said he illustrated with Kedusha. And he said, Kadosh, 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 distant, 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 transcendent, transcendent, transcendent. Now, when I was 15 years old, I didn't know what transcendent meant. But I heard it. He's talking about God. And suddenly it just got to me. It went through to me. Melo chol haaretz kvodo. This God, the Rav said, the Rav, I'm not quoting him exactly, this God who is distant and transcendent, unknowable, this God, melo chol haaretz kvodo, his glory fills the earth. That's the beginning. The second, and I didn't know, I never learned with the Rav at that point, but I knew that Gemara, the last name was Soloveitchik, you know. So Gemara was, you know, like, wow, the connection. During that summer, I also had the tremendous chut of learning with Rav Hirschsprung. Rav Hirschsprung was, you haven't heard of him, unless you've heard of him from me, but he's a person who, when he was 18 years old, I think, he was the person who tested people who wanted to come in to learn in Yeshivat Chach Bei Lublin. Some of you have been in the building. But it would be very difficult for me to go into that building because I feel the presence of Rav Hirschsprung. To get into the Yeshiva Chachmei Lublin, you had to know 200 daf of Gemara, Rashi and Tosfos. Gemara, Rashi and Tosfos. It didn't matter which 200 daf, and you had to be tested on them. You had to know it backwards and forward. When he was 18, he was the person who tested everybody. Okay? And he just kept learning, and he kept... So I was able to learn with him, proving that he was ready to learn with anybody, because I was a 15-year-old kid. But we had a chavruta for 6 weeks during the... It was what you call an uneven, an asymmetrical chavruta. Okay? But I met a person who was, what can I say? He just represented it was possible, all of these ideas, because until then I had been learning, I loved learning it, but it was about the ideas. It was real. Somehow this person had been transformed from all of this, and I really had an experience of what it meant to be religious, that it could transform you. Later on, of course, I had the zchut of learning with the Rav for a good number of years, and it just deepened it. I was only able to put a name to this. I was only able to put a name to this many years later when I studied sociology and I read a book by Peter Berger, which I recommend to all of you. Berger is a tremendously bright sociologist. I know, which is an oxymoron, but you know. He wrote a book called A Rumor of Angels, in which he tries to cite what he calls anthropological proofs for the existence of God. Okay, and I would say for me it came the connection between learning Gemara and the transformation that it took place, the uplifting that took place, you know. I can't, obviously, I can't put it in prosaic language. It's a problem. Rabbi Grummet will appreciate that what we're trying to do is, you know, like, explain music to you just by talking. I would say, I would have to write a poem about this. In other words, I'd have to get beyond words, Noam, to answer your question. And I can say that I have written a number of poems about this, okay? And they're my best expression, but that's, you know, if I were to get up and read a poem, everybody would run away. Okay, so that's what it is. Okay. There's Joe's.
So I just had a more general question. So we've been using the term spirituality for a good amount of time now. And just what do we really mean by that? Because for me, I mean, are we saying separate from the physical, like they're mutually exclusive? When you say spiritual, because it seems like it's being played like a Joker card, kind of like it's thrown out when. Because I personally do not know what people mean, because it's used in so many different contexts. The word spiritual, that I just lose sight of what it means, and like even like the term Ruach Neshama and then.
They all kind of come under
that
heading of spiritualness. I really don't know what it is. Like, is it just means everything not physical, part of life, everything that's somehow connected? Like, everything don't. What? There's
your answer.
Right? And that's what the struggle is for. Shiviti Hashem Lenegdi Tamid. Mr. Begner. Right? As far as your question about, you know, rote practice and spirituality, right? So that question, and I'm answering your question also, Mr. Benun, right? Both your names begin with B. So it says to get up in the morning, right? To get up in the morning to daven. So Jews get up every morning to daven. And the first haggah is Chas v'Shalom, don't be any later than the tzibur, because it goes without saying that you're going to daven with the tzibur. Right? But do it, right? And then the Ramah comes along and says, Shiviti Hashem Lenegdi Tamid. This is what it's all about, right? So step one, step two. Shiviti Hashem Lenegdi Tamid. If you say, listen, did you notice that people express things in different ways? The meeting with God takes place. Each Jew, right? Each Jew, each person meets God in his own way. There's no cookie press way of meeting God. But spirituality is the moment of relationship with Ribbono Shel Olam. Shiviti Hashem L'Negdi Tamid. Now, what you're saying, you have terms that you don't know, Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama. Okay, those are terms. Neither one of them, none of them, Tzelem Elokim. So you have to find out specifically what it refers to. Okay? But it's about however you define the human condition, however you define your talents. Okay? I told you the other day, did I not? Or I said to you the other day while I was talking to everybody, okay, that if you take it seriously, and it's not spam, at the end of the race, right, you're pointing heavenward.
So it's more a moment type thing?
It takes place in a moment. Read the introduction to the guide. The introduction to the guide speaks about, it's like a flash of lightning. He's talking about prophecy. It's a flash of lightning. Okay? He says it might take place once in a lifetime. Right? There's no recipe for how it takes place, specifically. Okay? The mitzvot are a guide. Right? But a person might be Mekadesh Hashem, which is a generalized mitzvah, and in that moment come to that kind of realization. But the question of terms that you threw out, four terms if I count them correctly, they're not relevant to the issue. You know, it's important to define them carefully, but they're not relevant to the issue. A person can experience God at the level of Nefesh, he can experience God at the level of Ruach, and the level of Neshama. Nefesh, Ruach, and Neshama generally are, you know, those terms are defined closely in terms of Kabbalistic thinking. Tzelem Elokim, something, maybe intellect, another one.
So if I understand correctly, a sort of event or occurrence or meeting with God is sparked, but then most of your life is not taken up by that. So then what state are you then? Are you not?
Joe, in life, most of life is not lived at peak moments. Okay? People don't live at peak moments, but it's the peak moments that give us the certainty to go on when we're not at the peak. Sometimes, in fact, in the nature of spiritual, religious development, Rabbi Nachman says, and everybody who's been through anything says, that the climb up is not like this, nor is it like this. It's like this. But when you straighten it out, when you want to put the line on the graph, it goes like that. But when you are falling, when you are doubting, when it doesn't seem to be going, you have to hold on to the certainty of the peak moment, or of the moment of certainty. Look, in the secular analogy is to the degree that it's relevant. Somebody comes to you and you're a therapist and they come, they're in depression. Okay? So the question is, do they believe they've ever done anything worthwhile? Have they ever been worthwhile? To nurture that is a tough job in the moment of depression. But it's other than Prozac or Zoloft, it's the way out. It really is. So, yeah.
Can I just make a comment? I hate the word spiritual. I don't think it's a Jewish word. I could be wrong.
It's
certainly English. I don't know its Greek or Latin roots.
But why do you hate it?
I'll tell you why I hate it.
Oh, okay.
Thanks for asking. I find that people hide behind the word spiritual, especially as there's this cloud of what exactly does it mean? And you know what? That doesn't make me feel spiritual. I had a guy once argue for me that keeping Shomer Negiah didn't make him feel spiritual. I don't know what that means. What I do know is that spiritual...
Okay.
Sorry. Spiritual means I feel good. When I feel spiritual, I feel high. Now, I think that one of the things that Rav Ebner was putting his finger on was that we believe that spirituality connects you to God. If you are being connected or feel high, feel spiritual for other things, That's not called spirituality. But I think that we very often like to hide behind that word. Because I say the word, oh, I'm spirit, you know, it's spiritual, so like, oh, okay, all of a sudden there's a, you know, you do your thing, I do my thing my way, you do it your way. Whatever makes you feel good, go ahead and do. And I find that to be very dangerous. I find you can go almost, you can say, claim, or do almost anything with that. And without really pinning down what does it mean, what makes you feel spiritual, and does it actually have anything to do with God, I think the word's a problem.
You mean we should ban it like the word awesome? Right. I will agree with you on that. Okay. But that's, after all, that's morality of the 20th century. I'm in the 20th century. I haven't gotten past that. But it was the morality of the 20th century. I mean, that's, Hemingway said it best. What's good is what you feel good after. Period.
So I kind of find that myself, and I don't know if this is a problem within like modern Orthodoxy in general or what exactly, but that the whole idea that, you know, all religion is just for convenience's sake and things like that, like I kind of do think that rings true with me. And so I think that spirituality or however, whatever this idea is clearly like the defining factor in helping me make my decision, like in terms of be religious or not or whatever. I'm not so sure I understand the definitions that I've been given, but to move on from that, I'm just wondering, Ramnul, you were saying that, and I mean this is open to everyone, Ramnul, you were saying that you came to like Machshava, and I was just wondering, how does philosophy connect to spirituality? Like, what is the relationship between the two?
Well, so it depends how you define it. I think that for many people, spirituality is thought of as on the affective level, the emotional level. So, I find clever ideas inspiring in a certain sense. I find that the idea that, like, to me, spirituality in a certain sense, I guess we want to use that term, is there something bigger than you out there? What you do is bigger than what you are. And I find that in the world of Machshava, at least in the Rav's Machshava, I find that, like, inspirational in a certain sense. The halacha becomes more than just the rote act, or more than what it is. You know, in the Lamedus, the halacha speaks on volumes of philosophy. Like I always thought of like, and I guess halacha to me was always the Rav had this its line, it's always, you know, the Rav, I actually was listening to a lecture by the chief rabbi, those from England know what I'm talking about. So the chief rabbi had a comment where his first comment to the Rav, the first thing he got from the Rav, and his only shiri, possibly the only shiri from the Rav, was the Rav said the halacha, that the, our Jewish philosophy comes from the halachic system. Right? Our life of practice is also our guide of like ethics, morals, but just a general idea. So to me, I find like the Machshava, at least the Rav Machshava, when I was in high school, I did a more medieval, and I didn't necessarily find the questions being posed so exciting to me. But when I discovered the Rav, which is basically was a college phenomenon, for me at least, it was interesting. I went to a modern Orthodox high school, but the Rav Soloveitchik was like maybe never mentioned. So I kind of knew who he was. Like they urged us to go to his Levi or his Hes, the Yisrael they made for him, but they never actually talked about him. And that, which was fascinating, I think it's just my Rebbeim, weren't from that mold. But I found the Rav inspiring that way, that kind of philosophy, that there was something greater than what I'm doing is greater, right, than just what I am. And I find that was like a certain way inspirational to me, and it gave kind of meaning to what I've been doing throughout my life. Someone else want to answer? All right. Yeah, Gabi.
Let's sit down, find the time to grab me, and we'll read the last chapter of The Guide to the Perplexed together. And I think that if you had to, if it, just for one thing to say, what is the connection between all of this, between philosophy and the religious life, the life in the presence of an other, capital O, okay? So then that is the last chapter.
Just to touch on the other side of this topic, the technology part, just out of curiosity, this might sound a little bit far-fetched, but I was wondering, what would the halakhic or religious implications be to there being, if we were to find, let's say, life outside of Earth? kind of like aliens.
I find a lot of aliens around here. I don't know about
it. Is it not a Jewish idea that the world? Is it not a Jewish idea that the world was created for human? That the world, the Earth, is the center of the universe. That universe was created for our purpose. That humans are unique and have a special compact and special connection with Hashem. Would finding that would not were not the case? Would that be very problematic?
We'll cross over when we come to it.
That's a terrible way to deal with problems. Okay.
Morning, take it.
I may be wrong. This question was addressed. The question was addressed. I think the first time that man stepped foot on the moon, it created a major religious crisis, certainly around the world and certainly within Judaism. Although I'm not one to tell you what it was like because I can't really say I was there, but I read about it. One of that crisis was there are a lot of things that we say, a lot of our assumptions may all be shattered or in the future may be shattered. Dr. Norman Lamb, the former president of Yeshiva University, wrote a 50-plus page article in Tradition that I'm pretty sure we once had in there about extraterrestrial life. There was the amount of literature, if you went on hebrewbooks.org, okay, and you search for the word moon, you would probably find around 20 different pamphlets and books written about the implications of man reaching the moon. I mean, even things just as, you know, when we say Berkat HaLevana, right? When we talk about Keshem Shani Roked Kenegdech V'eni Yachol N'Gavach, can't touch the moon. Well, and we can. In other words, everything changes. And how do we react to that? The quick answer, I mean, for me at least, is if we believe that God is all-powerful and that we don't understand why God does what he does, I assume God has plenty of time for all those other beings. We're here on this earth to do what we need to do. If at some point we discover another planet and we have some form of connection with them, then I guess that's what he wanted. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, there may be halachic issues. What do you do on the spaceship? Which way do you daven? I mean, there are lots of when Shabbos. I mean, there are lots of different halachic questions in that sense. But maybe there aren't. But I'm saying, fundamentally, why we're here, I don't think changes. I'm not sure it says anywhere that we are the only people around. I'm just not sure that it would change at all.
I'm sure that it wouldn't change at all. I mean, I just don't see what the problem is. Okay, what you're saying is that there are many people. I mean, I think this is true. There are many people who would see it as a problem. Okay, I can't answer for them. I don't see what the problem is. I don't see where there's any guarantee that there's no other life in the universe. We are the center of where we are. Here we are.
So within the idea of spirituality, I think, like in my mind, is you take the mitzvot is what you practice. And spirituality is what you feel. Like you don't practice spirituality. You feel spirituality, or sort of the other way around with mitzvot. And not that they, and the struggle or the goal is that you can find some kind of overlap between your mitzvah life and your spiritual life. That in some cases you can find ways to feel the mitzvah, and in cases find ways to think the spirituality. And when you've got the sort of crossing behind enemy lines of those two things, you achieve a sort of more a Judaism where you can not only motivate yourself but desire to do mitzvot, and where you don't only have to rely on feeling but really think about spirituality. The question is where the conflict really lies in where you have we're in yeshiva, we have tools, we're constantly reminded of the tools we have, but The issue is that how do you know yourself well enough to point yourself in a direction? Meaning, yes, you can look at a book that will tell you what other people have done, but I mean that isn't my spirituality. You know, the spiritual idea is supposed to be more personal. It's the Rambam spirituality or it's Rav Nachman spirituality. And the question is, how can you ever feel like you know yourself well enough to point at something and say, that is better, and point at something else and say, that is worse?
First of all, mitzvot are not just what you do. Indeed, it could be argued that the primary mitzvah Jewishly is exactly, quote, what you're doing now, which is learning Torah, which is dealing with ideas and trying to develop something out of it. Number one. Number two, you don't have to choose Rav Nachman or the Rambam or anybody, but you know, in the saying ascribed to Newton, but goes back hundreds and hundreds of years before him, if I have seen further, it is not because I am greater. What?
Thomas Salisbury.
In Merton wrote a book on it. Robert Merton wrote a book called "On the Shoulders of Giants." Okay, so he took it back to Bernard of Clairvaux.
That's right.
Okay, so On the Shoulders of Giants by Robert Merton. So which appears in Jewish literature also, you know. But if I've seen further, it's not because I'm greater, but as the midget, the dwarf who stands on the shoulders of giants, right? It's said of a certain German philosopher that Walter Kaufmann quotes this in The Faith of a Heretic, that he had four students, and when he died, one of them wore his hat exactly the way the master wore his hat. The other carried the cane exactly the way the master carried the cane. The third wore his spectacles the way the master wore his spectacles. And so on and so forth. But not one of them tried to be the true and honest person that he was. Okay? I think one of the main things beyond standing on the shoulders of giants and studying this so that you can find out what you see is to be as truthful and as honest with yourself. Now, there's a problem because nobody knows you, Don, better than yourself. And you know yourself least of all. Right? That's the problem of the insider and the outsider. But we try to do the best we can. We try to be honest with ourselves as best we can. We should try to learn from teachers, to badger them if they're not teaching us, and to grow from that, and to develop. Each one, b'tein chalkeinu l'toratecha, my Torah is not your Torah. Look, I get up here recently every morning, and I'm supposed to be teaching davening, and I say b'feirush, that these are just my kavanot. These are just my kavanot that I have now when I daven these things. The important thing is not for you to daven, because I'll daven for myself. I don't need you repeating. You know, somebody will say, daven with Ebner's kavanot, and God will say, wait a second, this is Ebner. You know, what are you doing? The important thing is for you to understand that tefillah is what you are doing. This tein chalkeinu b'toratecha. But Don, and all you guys, it doesn't happen overnight. You're all, the problem of technology, one of the problems of technology, let's get to technology, is that technology builds Emerson's better mousetrap. It's faster, right? So all of you have grown up in a generation. Look, I know it's hard to believe, but when I was in high school, there were no Spark Notes, there were no Monarch Notes, there were no Cliff Notes, right? You actually had to study something. What?
Were there classic comics?
For sure there were classic comics. What's the Shiloh? Okay? I mean, what's the question? Of course there were classic comics, but you knew it wasn't real. Okay, I don't want to, I'm not trying to idealize anything. I'm just saying there may be something gained by the better mousetrap, but there is a loss in technology in certain kinds of things because the thoroughness
and the idea that it's hard work to get this. People want instant answers. It's a problem. You can't give instant answers that are really, really meaningful. We live in an age of sound bites. Imagine Abraham Lincoln, right, debating Barack Obama. Okay? Imagine Lincoln could grow 10 beards and he wouldn't stand a chance against Obama. Why? Because the one is a soundbite man and the other wasn't. Have you ever read Lincoln's speech at Cooper Union? Well, go and do it. My God. How could you graduate high school and that? Well, not the English. The English. But Mr. Begner, we already established that you at City, you actually read Shakespeare. But you know that guys in America might read Spark Notes, right?
I'm appalled by the prospect.
Well, or in Hasmonean they might not have read it, you know? Like
Shakespeare
has
me.
What?
That's why you're an Arab Tzitzit.
The whole thing of technology, the whole issue. A good number of years ago, I had a student who was in charge. I think it was of getting speakers for the Orthodox Forum, or whatever, the Orthodox, whatever it was. You know, so he asked me if I would speak. This is, Josh Cyprus?
Yeah, sure.
So Cyprus asked me if I would speak about the internet. And I said, so what do you mean about the internet? So he says, you know, like how it could be, you know, you could use it for Torah. So I said, Josh, I find that very uninteresting. Okay? What I would be interested in is thinking seriously about the way the internet is going to change our whole perception of what knowledge is, of what understanding is. Okay? In the same way, if you will, that printing changed, it was much technologically. It was much more convenient, and made books more widely available. But it also shaped the way we see the world in a completely different way. And I think there are downsides to that we should seriously consider. The reason everybody, a couple of years ago, I was in a certain high school in the country called New York, and the principal asked me, he said, do you encourage the students to stay a second year? So I said, I know this person for a long time. I said, of course. So he said, well, then we're not going to send you any students. I said, why not? He said, because, you know, when I went to Israel, 1 year was enough. Right? I said, when you went to Israel, you know, and I took out my cell phone and held it up to him. I said, were there any of this around? So he said, no, you couldn't even find a phone a pay phone that worked. You know, all that kind of stuff. In other words, the promise of that technology offers us comes at a price. And that price is a price of tremendous distractions. Okay? Tremendous distraction. And you might need in life to learn how to focus. Right? And to focus in life Jewishly is to learn Torah day and night. So I just wanted the technology. That to me is an important question. In other words, the question of how much, when you come into shul, I remember a good number of years ago, not that long, I performed a wedding, and I announced before the wedding, would everybody please turn their cell phone off? And afterwards, you know, it was a wedding of Brits. So afterwards, they came over to me and they said, Rabbi, truly brilliant. Imagine, they never heard anybody ask people to turn their cell phones off. I was a groundbreaker there. Well, the question is that you know, the cell phones are with us. What kind, you know, could you live without a cell phone for a day, a week, a month? What does that mean? Could you live without all these technical? How many times a day do you check at home, let's say, or when you have your computer going on all day when you're in that kind of thing? Or even here, how many times a day, gentlemen, I'm not asking for, but think, how many times a day do you check email? Right? Think. You think. There. Some of this, gentlemen, is absolutely addictive behavior. Okay? So, all of this is not, whatever spirituality is, it's not a simple thing as far as technology is concerned.
I have two other responses to the question. One reminds me of a conversation I had with Chavruta of mine when I was in yeshiva. We were sitting and I suggested an explanation to something. And he said, you know, there are 70 panim la Torah. And when you suggest something new, you have to make sure that your explanation is not the 71st. I wasn't sure how to process that at the time, and I understand your question partly in that context. How do you know that the meaning that you're going to be putting in is a legitimate meaning? The fact that somebody else said it doesn't make it legitimate. The fact that nobody else said it doesn't make it illegitimate. What makes it a legitimate meaning is that if it rings true to you, if it rings true within what you're doing, and if the spirit of the meaning, if not the specific content of the meaning, falls within the parameters of the spirit of what you've learned Judaism is, and in order to be able to make that determination, you have to have learned what is Judaism and what's included in that spirit. Connected to that, you know, many of you know that in my shiurim, particularly in Chumash, I spend the bulk of our time focusing on something that I would call something close to pshat. One of the differences between pshat and drash is pshat, at least in my definition, one of the definitions is pshat is what the text says, and drash is what the text says to me. There can be right pshat and there can be wrong pshat. It's very hard to have wrong drash. And you want to know what's wrong drash. Well, the only thing that's wrong drash is if it's really wrong. Like a friend of mine who I went to yeshiva with, who is now a reconstructionist rabbi out in California, who performed at his own wedding. When they broke the glass under the chuppah, his explanation is, we break the glass under the chuppah in solidarity with the sadness of all the gay and lesbian couples who don't have a halachic way of sanctifying their relationship.
Spiritually gone, I think.
When it comes to drash, drash is what it means to you. And there are parameters. The parameters are really broad as to what an appropriate drash is and what an appropriate drash is not. And it emanates from a deep understanding of what you understand Judaism to be and to stand for. And in order to gain that deep understanding, you've got to learn what is Judaism and what does it stand for. That's one response that I have to your question. The other response that I have to your question is to point out that your question is not new. It may be new to you. It's not new to us. The question has been around for a very, very long time. I'll give you an example of how long it's been around. There were a group of rabbis somewhere in the range of 2,000 years ago, probably a little bit more than that, who actually decided that performance of mitzvot by itself did not engender spirituality. And they decided that prior to doing a mitzvah, people should recite a bracha. what is the function of a bracha? The function of the bracha basically says, this action that I'm doing is meaningful. This action I'm doing, I am doing it because I am commanded to do so. That's what it says. Baruch ata Hashem, Elokeinu melech haolam, asher kidishanu b'mitzvotav, sanctified me by giving me mitzvot, v'tzivanu, and he commanded me, it's not a suggestion, it's not a recommendation, he commanded me to fill in the blank, put on tzitzit, shake of the love, right? Whatever goes in there. When you think about that, that was Chazal's first attempt, or one of their first attempts, to deal with the question of spirituality and meaning. Interestingly, their notion of what spirituality was had nothing to do with emotion, had nothing to do with a feeling. Their notion of spirituality was, I accept the fact that, I dedicate my action right now. This action is dedicated to the fact that I am commanded to do so. That by itself takes a simple act of shaking a bunch of leaves and transforms it into a spiritual moment. And it can be a profoundly spiritual moment, even if it means nothing other than the fact that you are following a command from a divine being, from the divine being that you believe commanded you. That's a spiritual moment. Well, guess what? It worked for a while. And after a while, people discovered that they were saying the bracha by rote. So guess what? In Chassidut, and inspired by the Kabbalah, they came up with essentially the bracha before the bracha. The Shem, Yichud, Kutcha, Brichu, Shkinte, right? You'll find it printed in most Haggadot. It's the kind of thing that your grandfather mumbles and nobody else says, right? Without going into what it actually means, what it really is trying to say is, the act that I'm about to do, and even the bracha that I'm about to make, I want to acknowledge that these are religious acts. I'm eating maror now because I am commanded to eat maror. And that becomes a spiritual act. Now, it can have a spiritual impact on you in all sorts of ways because you've devoted this as a spiritual act. I give tzedakah, well, I can give tzedakah because I feel like it, or I can give tzedakah because there is a religious obligation to give tzedakah. And the religious obligation transforms it into something much higher than it might have been otherwise. It could transform it into something much lower. I do this only because I'm commanded to do so, and I would never do this otherwise. Right? But it can also transform it into something much higher. I do this precisely because I have a religious obligation, and it's important and it's meaningful to fulfill religious obligations. It's a whole different notion of spirituality.
I'm going to wrap it up with two comments. First of all, as long as we're talking about rabbis 2,000 years ago and spirituality and mitzvot, we can talk about quotation marks, inverted commas, counter rabbis 2,000 years ago who decided that they would go for spirituality without mitzvot. That's called Christianity. Okay, that's the first thing. The second thing is that for many of you, next year or the year after, you're going to be on campuses in which people are going to think that you are the Baal Shem Tov and the Vilna Gaon all wrapped up into one. And they're going to ask you questions. So use your time here well. Use your time here well. Because your ability, not necessarily to give answers, but to speak intelligently about something, will be based on what you know. And if you don't learn, you won't know. So, that's what you should be doing here, learning. Okay, it's a pleasure for me.